It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
You didn't really do any musical interlude the last time, I don't think. And now you're doing the Doctor Who theme? They probably don't even know who Doctor Who is.
That should have been way more, like, that's the crescendo there, and it came out really weak.
I need
some water.
I don't think they know who Doctor Who is over there.
I don't know who Doctor Who is over there either. Wait, what? Welcome to the alternate Magic Hat. We've tagged in because those losers are missing. I don't know. They're in your universe. You find them. Anyway, this is the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only interdimensional podcast for under $15. I'm Tony.
And I'm William.
And we have no idea what episode number this is. Nope. Again, your universe, you figure it out.
Not for us to ask or really even care. We're kind of forced to do this.
Otherwise
we wouldn't be doing it. Because we have better things to do.
For those who are unaware, the whole idea here is William and Tony found a magical hat in that you can email it and it reads its own email and produces the questions onto little bite-sized cards. And we draw them out of the hat randomly, so they come out in random order, read what you wrote to the hat, and discuss it until we're bored. And I seem to be switching my pronouns around here because we are alternate dimension. We are evil, Tony and William.
Right, we have goatees.
Who only show up when the others can't make it. So we really are doing them a solid, so it doesn't feel like we're that evil. But rest assured, William, across from me here, will take a penny and leave no penny.
That's right.
So,
and besides that, we don't want to do it.
That's
the key.
I'm not entirely sure they want to do it either.
Well, the point is, they should be doing it. This is their
deal. It's their deal.
And somehow we end up doing it when they just feel like, they're too lazy to drive over to the other person's house, or they think they're sick or something.
The multiverse sucks.
Yeah.
Totally.
Although I think it's this hat. See, that's another thing is, technically, we didn't find the hat. They did. But somehow we got sucked into this deal.
Yep.
Oh, well.
This is why I always say, you remember, I say this all the time, you should always kill your dimensional doppelgangers.
Well, duh. I mean, that's rule number one.
But you ever see the one? Let me rephrase. There's probably like 12 different movies called The One.
Yeah, I think probably.
Did you ever see the action movie, the action sci-fi movie called The One, starring Jet Li?
No.
It was terrible. It was an action movie, and the premise is that there were all these alternate dimensions, and that there was a double of everybody in all these alternate dimensions, and that they were linked in that, it's hard to explain. There was a finite amount of energy spread amongst all the different versions of an individual. And so if one of those were killed, all the others would gain a little bit more energy.
To what end? I mean, you didn't have to eat as much food?
You just became more superhuman and badass.
Oh, you had like abilities you would gain.
And what happens is Jet Li plays a guy that one of the dimensions kind of polices all this shit. And Jet Li plays a guy. Jet Li plays two guys who are the only two Jet Lis left. And one is part of this, like, enforcement agency in this dimension of this kind of shit. And the other one is the bad guy who's been hopping through dimensions, killing his other versions so that now he's a really badass. But it splits it evenly. So,
yeah, so
the good guy is also as badass. Really, yes. And powerful. And so it's a thing. And he wants to become the one, you know, so he'll be only one left. It was really pretty bad.
Well, that's just ridiculous. Everybody knows the reason you go to other dimensions and kill your other versions of yourself is just because it's fun.
And because then you don't have to do their podcast.
Yeah,
when they're
stuff safe. Like that. You don't get any special powers.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it'd be cool if you did, but that would just be frosting, you know? Gravy.
Gravy frosting.
The fun part is, you know, looking into the eyes of this other dimensional person and that the look on their face while it appears that they are actually killing themselves. It's hilarious.
Okay. For those who didn't think this was Evil William, he's starting to creep me out, so there should be no question at this point. Dude. That's messed up. All right. So here we are at Peter's Donuts. Shall we take out the hat?
I guess we should.
Do that thing that we do so average.
Really? You think we're average? Well, that's a step up. Dear TMTH, under what circumstances should someone quit or give up on a goal? Beth wants to know.
Beth always wants to know stuff like this.
Well,
that's the whole question?
Yeah.
All right. When it's too hard.
You're the wrong person to ask this
question. I am so the wrong person to ask.
Because
it is more difficult for me to define under the circumstances on which one should not give up on a goal.
Well, no, technically you don't give up on goals because you don't make them. On making goals, maybe.
I make goals. I haven't done it since we started the podcast. I used to send you all sorts of ideas and give up on them by the next day.
I suppose.
This is like, this and my marriage are like the first two things I haven't given up on, ever. They're also the last two things, because I haven't since.
Give up on a goal. That's a really good question.
I think the situation where this most often should come up is when it's a priority issue. When I have this goal, but I'm not going to be able to accomplish it unless I sacrifice this other goal, which is more important to me. The classic example being a career or a hobby or something that you are trying to be the best at, and you give it up because it is interfering with your marriage, and you realize that as much as you want this, your marriage is a more important goal, and the two are not compatible, and therefore you
actually, I think that's a very, very good answer. And it might be, yeah, that might be the only time it's appropriate is when something else that you, like you said, that you value more, where somehow these priorities or these goals are at odds with each other now, and you have to choose between one or the other, in which case you're going to have to give something up.
Okay.
You have to. You don't really even have a choice.
Now, so I'm going to throw one at you.
Okay.
I am 30-something.
That's an excellent answer, by the way. I'm really impressed with that answer.
I'm a super genius.
Really good answer.
I'm a 30-something. Me here. Mm-hmm. I am overweight. I have back problems. I have very poor vision. I have diabetes. I have high blood pressure. I, as we know, am quite lazy. I live in Iowa.
Wait a minute. That's not a bad thing.
No. But it is germane.
Okay. Just about everything
is
bad.
I have a bachelor's degree in cultural anthropology. What if my goal is to become an astronaut and go to the moon?
Okay. What if it is?
I shouldn't give up on that?
I don't know. By the answer you gave just a second ago, what other things are you going to have to sacrifice to make that happen, and are you willing to sacrifice them?
Well, this is what I'm wondering. Is that an illustration of that very concept? Because arguably I would have to sacrifice just about every aspect of my life.
Right.
Or is that another category when you say you give up on a goal when it is essentially impossible? Because I believe that's what that one is.
Well,
I believe. Walk us through how I could possibly do that at this point.
I don't even know. But
just basically, I would have to find a way to get rid of many medical issues.
Sure, but you would probably
I would have to go back to school.
Right. The short answer is, you'd have to spend a lot of money. Lots of it.
Yes, but I'm not even sure there would be enough.
Well, there's lots of ways to get money.
Really?
There's lots of ways to get a lot of money. The question is, are you willing to do those things or able to do those things, or are you willing to sacrifice the things you'd have to sacrifice to do those things?
That's the thing. The distinction between willing and able. Because what if you are not able to do the things to accomplish the goal, and you are aware of that?
Well,
I'm just trying to establish, is this an extension of the one circumstance we've come up with already, or is this a second circumstance?
Well, it's kind of hard to determine. I mean, maybe a better example would be... come up with something that would actually be impossible.
Same situation, but instead of an astronaut, I want to be a unicorn.
Exactly. You know, there are things that are just impossible, and that's just it. But that doesn't really count. I mean, in a way, some things like that are, you know, they're absurd, basically.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to find a category wherein something seems possible and is eventually revealed to be impossible. Or not even impossible, but nearly, where, because here's the thing. Let's say I'm willing to make all the sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of luck. There's a lot of random chance between me and becoming an astronaut, besides the money.
Okay, but this isn't about whether or not you actually become an astronaut. This is about whether or not you attempt it, whether or not you take the journey where you're trying to
make it. Yes, and for many folks, whether or not you attempt it is informed by the likelihood of whether or not you will succeed.
Okay.
So when we have
actually, it's more informed by the likelihood that you think it's going to succeed.
Yeah, the fact
of the matter is, a lot of people,
your perceived likelihood that it will,
or
succeed.
And a lot of people, even if they have a very realistic understanding of what the odds are, they don't care. They think somehow they can buck the odds, and that's what.
And is that the path you would recommend? As the likelihood of success approaches zero, do we hit a point wherein you would advise suspending your attempt?
I don't think that has anything to do with it.
Really? Okay, so for you, we still have that one circumstance set.
Yeah, to me...
Only when it becomes an issue of priority.
Now, certainly, I do think a person ought to be realistic when they approach tasks and find out, you know, what the odds are that this is going to work out. That said, I can think of a lot of situations where even if it's a long shot, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be attempted.
All right, so in the scenario here, assuming that really is my goal, I should attempt to become an astronaut unless other goals take priority. In this case, every other goal of my life.
Sure, for you. I mean, here's the thing. For me personally, if I know somebody who is chasing a goal that I think is really unlikely.
You go home and laugh at them.
No. In fact, that's not what I do. I don't feel like it. You know, it's my job as their friend to tell them, "Hey, look, this isn't going to happen, or this isn't going to work out." I think a lot of people do think that. I mean, in fact, most people who've ever accomplished anything will tell you that. When I say anything, I mean anything that seems extraordinary by other people's standards, will tell you that when they set out on the journey to attain that thing, that a lot of people told them it couldn't be done.
And I think that's the perk of being somebody's friend, is I get to tell them.
No, to me, that's a very cruel thing to do.
I get to be the one to say, you're an idiot.
No, I don't understand why people feel like they need to do that.
Have you ever done it?
No.
You should try it out.
No.
It's pretty awesome.
Because here's the thing. You know, I'm interested to know what a person wants to accomplish. And if I can help them accomplish that, I'm all for it. If I think it's a long shot, who cares what I think? If it really is a long shot and they don't care, why should I care? In fact, it's going to be encouraging to me if they achieve this thing. So
okay.
I'm going to get something out of them achieving it just like they will. So why should I discourage them? Why should I tell them, you know what, this is a long shot? I think, I don't know why the culture we live in is like that. That's when you tell somebody you're going to do something that not a lot of people have achieved, that instead of encouraging you, they discourage you. I don't understand that.
All right, William, I want to be an astronaut. Give me $20.
If I had $20, I'd give it to you.
Sweet. But you don't.
No.
Suck. What you got?
What you got? No, the point is, about the only time I would question a friend's goals in life.
It is my dream to become a serial killer.
Something like that. Uh-huh. Or if I felt like they weren't aware they were sacrificing something else very important to them. You know, and I'd say, no.
Which, a goal to become a serial killer does fall into that category.
Yes, but I mean, you know, like if you decided you were going to be an astronaut and it didn't seem like you were noticing the impact it was having on your wife, for example,
yeah,
I might, you know, try to help you understand that, because I would assume that if you understood that, you would do something about it and maybe you would decide, okay, this goal isn't worth the impact it's having on my wife. But otherwise, though, if you wanted to do that and it wasn't hurting anybody, and you were happy even just pursuing the goal, you know, much less, you know, you haven't achieved it yet, but you were happy pursuing it, why should I tell you, no, you can't do that? I mean, it's ridiculous.
Again, gonna say, try it. It's fun.
No, I don't know. I think our culture's...
So, Beth, we've come up with a one set of circumstances, and that's it. And given we came up with one and only one, and it seems to fit so universally, I'm gonna say we came up with the right answer.
I think what you came up with was correct. Really good.
TM, this is maybe the first time in the history of the show. We came up with the one true and only right answer.
In fact,
to this
I think if I'd sat here and thought about it, I would never have come up with that.
That's why I
you did,
keep the money.
You did a great job.
I mean, never mind.
Well, one reason I was going to struggle with the question was because.
Because you struggle with every question.
Well, no, the first thing I think, of course, is, well, you know, have I given up on a goal, and what were the criteria that led to me doing that? But I don't remember giving up on a goal per se, although...
I gave up on a goal to finish my entree last night at dinner, and I gave up. I took some of it home.
I had a goal to get into graduate school, and I didn't, and I suppose in a way I could have, you know, kept applying and whatever.
Oh, yeah,
but
some... dumbass little hinterlands graduate school would have taken you at some point.
But I think, well, I think I followed the rule that you're talking about because, for example, there were, like you said, there were some places that would have taken me somewhere, but I didn't
want to go
to, go to those places because I had goals.
And,
right,
yeah,
right.
Shit like that.
And so, I guess I don't feel like I so much gave up on that goal as... You know, the goal was very specific. I wanted to go to graduate school at this specific place, and if they didn't take me, well, they didn't take me, and so that's it. The goal gave up on me in a way.
Oh, goal. What were you thinking?
Although, you know, I could have stuck, you know, I could have broadened it so that I'm going to graduate school somewhere, but again, that conflicted with other goals, so I basically followed the rule that you just said, and I sort of left it behind. And I think that's the only time I've left a goal behind is when... under the circumstances that you just named, and I can't.
That's because we came up with the one true answer.
I can't think of any other. You know, you were saying, well, if a goal is absurd, I suppose you should abandon it. But
if it's absurd and you know it's absurd, I don't think it's really a goal.
Well, right.
I mean, a goal is not the same as a hope or a desire,
but
necessarily.
But the thing is, and you would never...
I can want to be a unicorn if I'm aware it's impossible. It's not going to be a goal of mine.
And you would never have the goal to be an astronaut. But if you did, and you were sincere about it, and you were pursuing it, honestly, and again, it wasn't hurting anybody else or getting in the way of any of your other goals, I don't know why anybody would come to you and tear you down and tell you you can't do that.
Because... We're in a feedback loop here because it's awesome. It's really fun.
Well, it's something about our culture that I really don't like.
It makes you feel better about yourself to tear down others. I've tried to instill this in you, my young apprentice, and you have not figured it out yet.
Do you have an honest answer for why people do it besides they just get a kick out of it? I mean, why do people do that?
No, it's that reason. It makes you feel less insignificant. You are threatened by somebody else doing something like that makes you feel that you feel less strong. You feel like you're weak because you gave up on your goals.
Well, that's ridiculous. What this person does has nothing to do with it. In fact, if this person sticks with their goals and even attains them, it has the potential to inspire you to maybe resume some of those goals or go back to them because it gives you hope that, well, this person can do it, I can do it.
People are always comparing themselves to other people.
But why do they compare themselves to other people, feel bad, and then lash out instead of comparing themselves to that person, get inspired, and do their own cool thing?
Because it's a defense mechanism. You feel bad, and you feel like they're better, and you can fix that. You can make them less better.
Or you can make yourself better.
No, it's harder. It's much easier to make them less better.
So it's the path of least resistance to tear people down and be critical.
Essentially.
It seems to me it takes just as much work, just as much thought and emotional investment to be negative as it would to be positive.
No, you can do it with very little thought and very little emotional investment.
Hmm.
It's very easy because you just prey on some insecurities there.
I know, but what I'm saying
is... To do the other, you have to overcome your own weaknesses. To do the former, you just have to point out theirs.
And you think it's difficult for people to overcome their own weaknesses to a degree that it's easier to point out somebody else's?
If it was that easy to overcome your own weaknesses, everybody would do it. You have weaknesses you don't overcome. Haven't you ever heard people talk about how I can totally solve everybody's relationship problems except my own?
Yeah.
I can raise anybody's kids except my own.
Okay, but...
It's always easy when you're looking from the outside.
No. I realize that, but what you're talking about is something more specific than the general, yes, everybody has problems they can't overcome. You're talking about, you know, if a person has certain goals or aspirations in life, and they have a sense that they've given up on them too easily... Okay, then either fix that and pick them up again and try again, or make peace with the fact that you gave up on this and maybe you didn't want it as bad as you thought. Why take it out on this person if it's your problem?
It's easier. I'm telling you, it's much easier.
Okay, but it's easier than just letting go of it yourself? Because, okay.
Oh, yes, that's incredibly hard. That's probably the hardest path of them all.
Why? Because if deciding if giving up on a goal prematurely, you know, like you realize you probably didn't put as much effort into it as you could have. If that's easy, why isn't it even easier to say, well, I guess I didn't really want that goal and
because
just forget about it altogether?
Because you can still be in denial. I can still do it someday. I'm still going to get there.
Okay, but then if you think that, then why aren't you inspired by this person doing
it? It's a bullshit rationalization. You're not actually going to do it. You know that. Okay. Deep inside, you are in denial.
So... What you're telling me is there's a lot of work going on here in your brain to make all this work. That seems sounds like a lot of work.
No.
The rationalizing and the denial and the repression.
Very, very simple.
It sounds like a lot of work.
No,
it sounds
it's extremely easy.
It
we
sounds
all do
really
it without even thinking about it. All the rest of us, not you, William. You know
No.
The rest of us do it without even thinking about it. It is. You understand defense mechanisms, right? That's what this is.
No,
that's what
yes.
all of this is.
Yes, I know, but
these are irrational defense mechanisms.
There seems
done
to be
reflexively.
There seems to be something else going on. There seems to be. I agree with you. It's easier, but I don't think it's easier in the baseline. I mean, I think at the bottom of it all, it's not really easier. I think our culture makes it easier, because I think our culture, there's something about our culture that makes it hard to achieve things, harder than it needs to be. And so I think one of the reasons why people give up on goals isn't really because a person lacks confidence or they think the goal is hard or anything else. I think they give up because they get tired of swimming against a whole bunch of unnecessary obstacles. And that's probably the thing that they're really jealous of these other people, is that they don't seem to be letting those obstacles totally stop them.
And you might be right, or you might be rationalizing because you're in denial about an actual truth of human civilization.
Well, that's just it. You do really think every human culture is like that? You can't imagine a human culture where...
I'm not saying that. I'm not actually specifying, because I don't know. I've never actually sat down and said, is that normal? I know it's unhealthy. To me, it doesn't really matter, because I know it's unhealthy. I know it's not the... It's not what ultimately is going to make me feel better. So whenever I have the conscious choice, I don't do it, but I do it unconsciously all the time. I never, when faced with it, am like, you know what? I would rather make them feel worse than try and make myself feel better.
My point is, if our culture was different, I think even though people would still be tempted to do that kind of thing, because you're right, it's kind of part of the human thing.
No, and I'm not saying that's true.
The impulse to be inspired or to encourage the person would also be there, and they could just as easily pick that
one. Yes, and what I'm saying is your identification of this thing in our culture that makes it happen is so nebulous that I feel like you're just guessing or hoping that that's
true.
No,
I don't think so. I think it's part of the whole...
Well, then you got to bring more stuff in.
Well, I think it's part of the whole bully culture we live in. Bullying is everything. You're taught from a very young age that, okay, well, get ready, kid. I mean, enjoy childhood as much as you can. Believe in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny and pretend the world is big and magical, because eventually you're going to get to an age where you realize it's not that at all. And everyone's just a bully. Your boss is a bully. Politicians are bullies. CEOs are bullies. And your job in life is to try to bully other people so that you can climb the ladder, so you're bullying more and more people all the time and fewer people are bullying you. And this is a horribly oppressive situation for people to grow up in and live in. And I think it's very natural in that situation for most people to decide, screw this, you know, I'm going to have a 9-to-5 job where I do the minimum level of work and where it's I don't have to think about it very much, and I can go home with a big enough paycheck that I can enjoy life with my family and go on 2-week vacations once in a while.
I agree with everything you're saying, and I think there is very strong evidence for it. Now what you need to prove your point is a different culture where you can show evidence of the opposite of that. Have you got one?
Specifically, no.
Well, you got to find one of those first. Otherwise, the possibility, not the certainty, but the possibility exists that this is just how people are. And when they get together in civilizations, this is what happens.
Well, but see, another thing, other information I have at my disposal...
I'm not saying I believe that.
No, I know, but other things I have... I know, and other things I have at my disposal are certain psychological and sociological knowledge where I don't see anything in that body of knowledge that supports the notion that this is just the way humans are.
But
so,
unless you've got...
A cultural explanation is all that's left.
Unless you've got an actual culture to look at, you're still dealing in theory.
Well, yes, I suppose that's true, but...
So you got to show me one. And there have been a lot of them. Unfortunately, some of them it's harder to dig into about what that kind of stuff was, the nature of what we have gleaned from old and gone civilizations isn't there.
Well, I just know that from a sociological perspective, what we're talking about here are tyrannical relationships. But I know that other relationships exist. And it stands to reason that if you can base an entire culture on the tyrannical relationship, you can base an entire culture on any of the other relationships you want, including the solidary relationship, which doesn't have bullying involved in it.
And what you just gave was essentially a common sense argument, though. Just because you are capable of coming up with a different concept of relationship does not mean that humans
are
capable of...
No, I'm not coming up with a different... these relationships exist. I mean, they're in. You can verify them in the lab. People have solidary relationships. They have exchange relationships.
And have
they
any have civilizations been built on them?
Well, I would say that. Well, I don't. You know, when you ask civilization, I mean that's a loaded word.
Well, cultures, whatever.
Oh, I don't know how they couldn't have been.
And again, that's a common sense argument there.
Well, the notion that out of the 9 different relationships that have been isolated in the lab as human relationships that are universal, the idea that only one of them has been the basis of any culture is, that can't be true. And not only that, but yes, I can think of cultures that are based on solidary relationships, and I think everybody can because lots of people have their own little tribal groups where nobody's the tyrant in that group. Nobody's the authority in that group. Everybody's equal, and they treat each other equally. That's evidence. There's a little culture, a little
tribal
culture.
How far can you scale it? How far can you have evidence of scaling it for me?
Scaling it?
How big a polity can you give me where that works?
Oh, not big at all. Mm. In fact, I think sociology suggests that it's impossible to maintain that beyond 50, 100. Impossible.
Then I don't know why you ever argue any of the rest of yourself.
Because I'm an anarchist.
You should just argue that everybody needs to hang out in smaller groups.
Well, they do, though. I don't have to argue that they should. They do.
I mean, no, but I mean,
tribalism
you need
is just
to
how
stop arguing about... Because ultimately, what you're saying is... Ultimately, all your talk about what's wrong with modern society and Western society is one thing. It's too big.
Well,
because everything you describe, and we've had this conversation before,
it comes down to that,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I don't know why you argue the other points, because clearly that is the solution and that is the root cause.
Right, but
so what's the rest of it about? Why do we care about the rest of it?
The rest of it is about if that's what it all boils down to, it's too big. Then the next question is, why is it too big and how can it not be so big? And when you examine that, what you realize is that, as you pointed out, everybody already hangs out in small groups. Everybody already... Tribalism has never gone away. It's still the way everything gets done. What has to happen is people have to stop living under the delusion that these other higher structures or whatever really has any control over them. And what's happening, I think, when people tear down other people and their aspirations is they're letting the reality of this larger culture that people believe in, this larger American culture, Western culture, kind of infect their thinking. They're not stopping and realizing, hey, wait a minute, I don't have to conform to this bloated bully culture. I don't have to submit to this. I have friends. I have people I care about. We can change the tide of this. We can take control of this. We don't have to be slaves to what our culture and our society is telling us, but people don't make that choice. They get discouraged and they just decide to sort of give up, it seems to me. And if fewer people gave up, something could be done about it. The tide could be turned, I guess. But, you know, research has shown that for any type of change in any given group, at least 10% of that group has to be like true believers in that change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then it's almost like magic. If it's 9%, nothing will happen. It's almost like the group doesn't exist. But as soon as it hits that magic 10%, it's almost inevitable that it's going to sweep through the group. But, you know, 10% can be, you know, one person in a group of 10 or in, but for what I'm talking about, you need 10% of the entire population of the United States.
35 million?
Or something like that. A huge number. And obviously, there's not that many people who, and they have to be true believers. They have to think to themselves, gosh, that's right. We can really turn this around. But people don't have faith in that. There's a lot of pessimism and cynicism, which some people think is inevitable, or some people think if it's not inevitable, it's a defense mechanism that protects me and I feel better by not getting my hopes up, or like you say, giving up on a goal because you don't think you're ever going to attain it. You don't want to be disappointed down the road or whatever. I don't think these defense mechanisms really help people. I think it just makes them miserable.
Oh, no, absolutely. And the sad thing is just about everybody will agree with you, including people who participate in those mechanisms, including myself, which to be fair, I think we all participate in those mechanisms. This is the thing, though. You understand it. You know what's going on. I don't know why you always act so confused. because you have an answer. Whether or not I agree with you, and I think I pretty much do, you have an answer. So you're always like, why are people like, you know why. You've just explained why. That's pretty much the answer to every question you've ever asked me, and you already know that. So I don't know why you always seem so mystified.
Because there is a choice factor. I mean, people can make choices. They're miserable, and I do think they could make choices so that they wouldn't be so miserable.
If they were aware, they're born into the culture, they're educated in the culture, they don't understand the concept you're talking about. In that case, you're talking about changing their perspective. You're talking about introducing concepts that are alien to them because of how they were acculturated in their life. They have to be taught.
Yeah, that's true.
And again, I'm not disagreeing with you. I just don't know why you get confused, because you seem to understand it real well. And I almost feel like sometimes when you ask those questions, that's your defense mechanism.
No, because
you say why, because you're hoping that you've missed something.
Well, there is that. But also, like in the example of what we're talking about, tearing somebody down, empathy is something that human beings have to have in order just to have regular human consciousness.
Yes.
Even if a person doesn't understand all the concepts I've been talking about because they haven't been taught.
Yes.
When they tear that person down and they see the look on their face and they, you know, they're in that social situation, I just know some part of them can feel how horrible.
Absolutely.
It is.
Absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
And so when they feel that, doesn't something go off in them and make them think, wait a minute, there's something wrong with what I'm doing here?
Sometimes it does. Sometimes it doesn't. Empathy always exists. It's a spectrum, however, and the two things are at war, the culture and the empathy. What they've been taught, what they believe because of what they've been taught versus what they feel. And sometimes empathy wins, and you know that because sometimes people don't tear other people down.
No, that's right. That's right.
Or at best, like in a case like me, sometimes they try and keep themselves from tearing people down. I still do it sometimes, but I try not to. Whenever I can consciously think of it, I try not to. And so you know it's there. I mean, it's all hope is not lost, but it's a struggle. And sometimes the culture wins. Often the culture wins.
Well, I think whenever you have a culture where people are setting aside those important choices to help each other out, to lift each other up, and to be there for each other, but instead they're going to push each other away and sort of to protect themselves. I think we're talking about a culture that is really on its last leg. I mean, a culture like that can't last. Society can't last, built on tyrannical relationships and suspicion and cynicism and pessimism. It just can't work that way. I mean,
Well, how long do you think that's been going on in this one?
Since the very beginning.
What's the very beginning of this culture?
Well, it depends on what you mean. Well, I mean, if we're talking about...
You're the one who used the phrase since the very beginning, so what did you mean?
Well, I could have meant various things depending
what
on...
What did you mean?
Well, in this case, I meant since the very beginning of the United States. I'm talking about American culture, the United States.
All right. So this process here has gone on for 200 and some odd years.
Right. But of course, it was built on something that came before. I acknowledge that. But yeah, when I answered your question, I was thinking of the United States. So yeah, I think it's always been that way. And I, you know, there's been some improvement in terms of how certain people are treated, of course, in certain places, but I'm not sure the net effect has been an improvement, because it seems like whenever something improves in one section, it gets worse in another section, or when something improves for this group of people, it improves maybe in the public sphere, but in the private sphere, something is taken away. And, you know, maybe this person can get certain work that they couldn't get before, and maybe they even get paid as much as people of the other group, but, you know, in order to achieve those goals, they've had to behave in a work twice as hard, say, as the other group,
or there becomes or give up certain
other things
priorities.
So the net gain is, I don't think, has really been positive, and it frightens me because, you know, I worry about the whole thing crashing and a lot of people being hurt by it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it concerns me a lot. I guess I think about it a lot. How if things don't get better, you know, it's already there's a lot of people suffering in our country, much less every place else, needless suffering, and that's bad enough. But when it finally falls apart, like it seems inevitable to do, what's going to happen?
And it's a social apocalypse. And in your model, I hate to say this because I know how it does to you, but in the model you describe, if I place it on the society we live in, that's the only outcome that I see.
I know.
I don't see one in which things get fixed.
Right.
Things get leveled and then theoretically start again.
Thinking about that, it really bothers me. But, well, what can be done, I guess? I mean, all we can do is...
Well, you can still try. Even the likelihood... Didn't we just talk about the likelihood of success in a goal is not necessarily
the
measure of...
Of its worth to attempting, right. That's right. Absolutely. But, you know, it really doesn't... My anxiety about it has no bearing on whether or not I think I should do anything about it, except that maybe it makes me feel stronger about doing something about it. But, you know, as you just pointed out, sometimes when I consider it, I think about it, it looks like, you know, some kind of cataclysm is almost unavoidable, which sometimes when I think about that or when I speak it out loud, it sounds so stupid and absurd, but that the evidence that that's going to be the case seems so, there's no arguing with it.
No, and I actually think it's a fairly strong, there is a fairly strong movement in society that is the case. Unfortunately, with it is the belief that it is essentially inevitable at this point.
So
a lot of people, I think, believe that some sort of apocalypse, and barring any other kind of social apocalypse, will occur.
How do you feel about that? I mean, do you just not really let it trouble you, or there's no point in your mind to being troubled about it?
Honestly, if I'm honest, not just with you, with myself, which is the harder part. I don't know that I believe what you believe in that sense, but I think that's because I don't let myself think that far through it, and I essentially shut it all out and try... I focus on my life and making my life good.
Well, that's really all anyone can do anyway, so... I mean,
no, there's lots you can do for others.
And well, I know,
work
but...
hard not to, and I do enough that I feel like I'm doing stuff, but ultimately, and especially since I've decided not to have kids, I say, you know, maybe it'll happen. I'll probably be dead before it does. Or if it happened now, I would probably be one of the first to die.
See, I don't like thinking about that.
I don't either, so I don't very often... If forced to, that's how I think of it. And I think, you know, I could be doing things and I'm not. And there's lots of things I could be doing and I'm not. I have a lot of hypocritical aspects to myself. If I really stuck to my guns on my principles, I would, among other things, probably be a vegetarian, if not a vegan. I would probably be much more socially and politically active. But I don't do those things. And in general, I don't think about them too much. And when I do, I sort of shuffle them away. I've become largely selfish on such issues. And it's not even a good rationalization, because, yeah, I have no kids, but I have nieces and nephews that I love to death. And I have almost nieces and nephews, the neighbor kids, you know. There is still a generation out there that I give a damn about pretty strongly that is going to have to live with whatever's left.
Right. And what's that like? I mean, does that ever, like, do you ever sit there and you see what's happening around you, and does it ever hit you like, gosh, this is, I wish these kids had a better world that they were going into, you know?
Yep. It does. Not very often. I've gotten pretty good at keeping that from myself.
Because it really hurts, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Denial. Denial is arguably the most effective defense mechanism. Don't think about it. Come up with a reason why it's not really true. That kind of thing. And in this case, the one I do is to say, we don't really know. We make a lot of conjecture. You know, if we really had the power to see what society was doing to that degree, we would be much more significant and educated and influential people, is what I tell myself. None of which is true. But I plead ignorance a lot as an excuse not to think on such things, not to think it's going to be really bad. How do I really know, you know?
I suppose if the alternative is just to be miserable, then that's probably a decent way to go about it. Although I don't think I'm miserable. I wouldn't call myself miserable at all.
Well, and the alternative is to let it inspire you.
You said something interesting in the last mystery episode. You said, for someone who has so much self-knowledge or whatever, that I suffer a lot, and I didn't understand that. Is there something about having self-knowledge that would relieve someone's suffering?
Well, I would think if you really were aware of yourself, then you would be aware of, basically, if you could truly, how do I put this? If you can truly understand a problem, you should be able to understand a solution. And while the solution to the problem of global society might be outside of your realm, it stands to reason that, for the most part, I would think, the solution to the problems inside William should be within William's power to alleviate. So if you know what it is, I would think you should be able to be pretty good at fixing it.
Well, but I don't think that the suffering you observe, whatever that is, really has so much to do with something in me that I can't fix. Except that I sometimes get discouraged with myself that I can't figure out how to make myself more effective in, you know, having a positive impact on the tiny part of the world that I can have an impact on. I mean, I'm not so deluded as to think I can change the whole world or make a huge difference to everybody. But, you know, I do know people. I do have close relationships with people, and those people I can make a positive impact with, you know, presumably. And when it seems I've failed to do that, or I'm failing to do that, and I can't figure out why I'm failing to do it or how to fix it, yeah, that bothers me a lot. But I don't know if that's really a problem with me or if
the problem is with the world.
Obviously there's a dynamic interchange there, but the point is, I don't see how self-knowledge really is going to help that per se, unless there is something very specific that I'm doing or not doing that I could discover.
I feel that, in my mind, self-knowledge should be the primary resource for dealing with one's own issues and problems in oneself. So, theoretically, full self-knowledge should allow one to deal with the issues and problems that are within oneself.
Okay, right.
Beyond that, then, the problems you have aren't yours, it's the world.
Okay, well, saying it like that, then I would say that most of the so-called suffering you see me enduring, it's probably a lot less about me than it is about the world, or at least my interaction with it, or how I perceive that interaction working out. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if it really has so much to do with, you know, torturing myself or anything like that. I don't hold myself responsible for everything that happens in the world, or even for everything that happens to the people in my sphere of influence. But
I would think you would have a better self-image then. If you really think most of the problems that you have aren't because of you, they're because of the outside world.
I have problems. I mean, I'm not saying I don't have any problems. But maybe what it comes down to is that you know, as we've often discussed, people have blind spots, people have whatever. In a way, it's inevitable for when it comes to dealing with your own problems, because it's the whole process is self-referential. There's going to be something there that you're never going to see.
I think that is what it comes down to.
It gets caught in some little vortex or whatever.
In my experience, there is a sort of an inverse proportion between breadth and depth when it comes to self-knowledge.
Right, so
the people that I have met that seem to really have a grasp on who they are and what's going on in them, over time I sort of see that that is true for a particular bandwidth of them. And right. For the others, they're remarkably more ignorant than most people.
Okay, well, so imagine a hypothetical person who has pushed their self-knowledge to the limit that it can go. And I'm not saying I'm that person, but imagine someone like that. Doesn't it stand to reason that once they hit that sort of nugget and they really can't go any farther, it violates the laws of consciousness for them to reach into that space? Now, I believe that it doesn't mean you can't know what's going on there, but it means you need someone else to help you see it.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be hard for that other person to help, but whatever. If a person reaches that sort of nugget and other people are having a hard time or maybe don't even seem interested to help them see what they can't by nature see, doesn't it stand to reason that that would just drive them crazy? That they can't know what that is when that might be the very thing that is preventing them from succeeding in things that they seem to consistently fail at? You see what I'm trying to say?
I do. I mean, I believe I understand the point you're making.
And that would cause, I would think that would cause a person to suffer a great deal. You know, in that kind of situation.
I would agree. That seems like a very specific sort of situation to me.
Well, it's a hypothetical situation, but...
No, but I mean in general, the idea that essentially one has reached the limits of self-knowledge that one can achieve by oneself.
Well, and
that one can only proceed with other assistance, and yet one cannot seem to convince, coerce, or cajole outside forces into helping.
Right.
That seems like two or three difficult circumstances that have to overlap.
Well, I suppose. But I guess I don't think that I fit that hypothetical specifically, but what I experience is something like that. I don't know how to describe it beyond that, I guess. I think that's probably what you perceive. Is that, and I don't think perhaps I haven't reached the limit that, you know, any human can reach, but well, I've reached a limit for me, obviously.
Well, and I do find it odd. Well, I don't know that I think that's true either. I don't think anybody ever reaches their personal limit in their life. I'm always
wondering. Well, no, what I mean is, I haven't reached my personal limit, but whatever is standing between me and that personal limit is still something that I'm having a hard time.
Yeah.
Penetrating, you see what I'm saying?
I would argue the concept of I feel like, though it may not be huge, you have a very distinct and strong support network that could help you insofar as that would be possible. I think you have a lot of willing participants. I can think of a definitive two, a likely three, four.
Well, no, you're right about that, and I'm perfectly aware of that. But then I have other things to struggle with in that regard, like, you know,
intimacy.
No, it's more like...
No, I think that's some of it.
No, I think it's more of a... Again, these are the very people who I sometimes feel like I'm disappointing. And to go to them for even more help than I already feel like I've burdened them with, you know, that sometimes doesn't seem like an option. So, you know, there's a feedback loop going on with that too, downward spiral and all that. So that's a struggle. But, you know, it's not something that's paralyzing me or debilitating me or anything. It just makes it hard. Again, I'm trying to explain what I think this suffering is that you're noticing. It's a lot like the stuff I'm talking about now, and it's not static, and it doesn't stay bad, or and it's not always bad. You know, there's good days and bad days, but I don't think I'm at the end of it all. I really don't think I'm suffering more than other people are.
Well, I don't want to poke too big a hole in your self-knowledge, but just so you know, and I mean this with 100% sincerity, don't come back with some sort of disbelieving denial. I'm fairly confident that you have literally never disappointed me in any regard worth mentioning, ever. In the entire time I've known you. And I cannot particularly think of another person for whom that's true.
Well, I don't want to bring up specific instances, but I mean, you know, there have been times where you've seemed disappointed to me.
Oh, I'm sure there have been many times when I've seemed disappointed to you.
Well,
some of those is because I'm such a great actor. but some of those I think may have been you biasing your perspective.
That's true.
The thing. And this is why I bring it up, because it would be useless to say, I think you've disappointed me a lot less than you think you have. But in this case, I'm pretty clear cut. And don't get me wrong. I have been unhappy with you. I have disagreed with you. I have even been angry with you. I don't know that you have ever disappointed me. Worth note, there have been times where, like, I'm hoping he's going to say this when I say this, and he doesn't, you know? Along the lines of, you know, I'm hoping that if I say, Dad, can we go get ice cream? He'll say yes, and he says, no, not tonight. We have something to do. You know, that's a disappointment. But it's not, you know, it's not I'm disappointed in you, you know? It's
yeah.
None of those, ever.
Okay, I get it. Well, that's good to know.
Well, and I don't say that to make you feel better.
No, I know that.
I say that because I want you to consider that in your perspective.
Right.
If that's true for me, what does that mean overall?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. But
and I'm sorry, but our hour is just about up, and I have another patient coming. Wow, they are gonna love this in the Prime Dimension. This episode has a lot of substance to it, people. In case you didn't know, I love that I'm summing it up after they've listened. But it is not a funny episode.
No.
Or at least not funny, haha.
Well, you know, it serves them right over there. They give us these. They make us do this. Why should we?
This is what you get, people.
Yeah, why should we be entertaining? Why should we help them?
No, this is what you get with the podcast overall. Sometimes we're funny, sometimes we're entertaining. The point is, we are quite genuine. And when you're genuine, this is the kind of stuff that comes up. And this right here, people, is why you find us oddly compelling. And you know it is. And if that's not true, maybe you need...
like a car crash.
...to look into yourself and decide if really you want to be listening to this podcast. And you better decide yes, or I will come to your house and tell you the story of when I first filed taxes in Iowa. An amazingly boring story. It is the boring story. It is the best sleep aid in the world. Seriously, the only thing that can keep you awake is how shocked and amazed you are at how boring it is. Anyway, if you want to write a question that should spark an entire therapy
yes,
session.
Yes, thank you, Beth, for that.
You should write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com.
I have some serious issues.
You also should go on the blog and tell William how he's disappointed you over the years. Yeah. It's like Festivus.
You might not want to send questions in that...
TheMagicalTalkingHead.com.
That, you know, trigger issues.
Or you might want to. I think as long as this doesn't become our weekly routine, I think episodes like this are very powerful and very interesting and quite valuable.
Okay, well, I hope so.
All right, people. So lock it up for the night. Go home.
Lock it up.
You don't have to stay here, but you can't wait. Shit. Anyway, we'll talk to you the next time they can't get their crap together.
Yeah.
In the meantime, enjoy their banter.
Later.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.